Call the meeting to order. I'm dealing with electronics, so bear with me. Okay. Let's see. Public comment. Any member of the public may speak on any item which is on the agenda. The board will only allow comments by members of the public on any item on the agenda during consideration of the item. When the item is called, please raise your hand and the chair will recognize you. The general public at the beginning of the regular agenda during the public comment period may address matters under the jurisdiction of the board and not on the posted agenda. However, any person wishing to make a presentation must submit their issue in written form with copies furnished to board members. Presentations will be limited to 3 minutes. Board agendas, minutes, and copies of items to be considered by the Board of Retirement are customarily posted on the internet by Friday afternoon, preceding your meeting at the following website, and that's stansara.org. Materials related to an item on this agenda submitted to the board after distribution of the agenda packet are available for public inspection at the Stansara address, which is 832 12th Street, Suite 600, during normal business hours. Do we have any non-English speakers in the group? Just check. This would be you. Okay, so calling the meeting to order.
And roll call is Maria DeAnda.
I'm here.
Jim DeMartini. Mike Fisher.
Here.
Gordon Ford. Darren Garrett.
Here.
Wes Hall.
Here.
Mike Lynch. Ron Martin.
Here.
Clarence Willman.
Here.
Linda Stoss-Burnett. We have a quorum.
Announcements.
I have two announcements. Graham Schmidt, who's here from EFI, has told me that he's been awarded, or the EFI has been awarded, the consulting actuary services for Merced, Sarah. County Employees Retirement System. Very good. And the second item is the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 10,015.86 today.
All right.
About 10,000 for, I don't know, what time. Ron, is that the third or fourth?
It was
a
6,500 in March 9th.
Somebody brings their own entrance music. Hey, any public comment? Okay. Consent items.
I'll make a motion to approve the consent items as noted on the agenda.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any additional discussion? Okay, so moved. Okay, EFI actuaries have a presentation. Oh, I'm sorry. I do need a practice run. Sorry. Thank you for the reminder. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, EFI actuaries presentation.
Thanks. We have two presentations for you today. The first is titled Funding Policy Discussion, and then the second is an overview of the material we intended to present at the fall workshop that you all have scheduled with the stakeholders in the pension plan. I'm going to go through the funding policy discussion first, as it also, a lot of the information is then contained in the stakeholder discussion as well. I think you've also received a couple documents. One is an article from the Voice of San Diego talking about similar discussions that were also occurred recently down at the City of San Diego. And you also just received a document that Kelly printed out called the Recommended Practice for Funding of Public Employee Retirement Systems. And this is a document that was approved by the GFOA last year, the Government Finance Officers Association. It directly relates to a lot of the funding policy discussions. So, if you have a copy of the funding policy discussion, it's got some slides and room for notes on it, and we're also looking at the presentation up here. The origin of this presentation, Tom contacted us and said that there are board members interested in hearing about the issue of asset smoothing, specifically issues about the length of amortization, length of the smoothing periods, and what we call the corridor on the actuarial value of assets. We really felt strongly that any discussion of one element of funding policy really needs to be incorporated in the discussion of overall funding policies, because they interact with each other when you're determining the amount of the employer contributions and the funding level of the plan. So the second slide, we'll first start a little bit, talk a little bit on the objectives and the constraints of funding policies, and then some of the individual elements within those funding policies. Amortization, assets moving, contingency reserves, excess earnings, and other policies that can be incorporated in a funding policy. And Tom actually just informed me that back in 2003, the board actually put together a one-page funding policy summary or a recommendation thereof. I don't know if it was actually adopted by the board or not, but it does contain many of the elements of a funding policy that we'll discuss here today. And feel free to stop me at any point along the way. Okay, so some of the objectives of funding policy. Why do we actually need one of these? Well, the first thing is because the actuary is always wrong. Right? We are never going to be correct, absolutely correct on all of our assumptions about future events, even in the long term. Most importantly being the asset returns, right? Because those have the largest impact from year to year on the funding of the plan and the cost of the plan. What the funding policy does is it gives you a self-correcting method to get back on your desired path. Remember, Bob and I have talked about your accrued liability being a target for where you want your assets to be. So the funding policy gives you the rules for how you're going to get back on track to that funding target. Some of the objectives that would reflect in your funding policy, now this is a primary one that's contained in the 37 Act, and that's to protect the payment of the promised benefits to the members. That's your primary fiduciary duty. There's a secondary duty within the Act, and it talks about minimizing the cost and the volatility for the employers. Also, the concept of generational equity is very important. Taxpayers should be paying for the services that they receive. This GFOA practice note also echoes some of those same objectives. It talks about trying to get a contribution that's level as a percentage of pay between generations. Also mentions generational equity and recognizing costs when the services are rendered. So it echoes many of the things that are already contained in the 37 Act. When we are evaluating the funding policy, we need to look at the element as a whole on the current and future plan dynamics. If you were to talk about changing your amortization policy 1 year and then changing your asset smoothing policy another the next year without looking at the overall impact on the funding of the plan, you might miss some issues that could come up in your achieving your objectives. Things that we need to look at are things like projections of cost, projections of the funding ratio. Bob and I have also discussed with you several times the concept of the inactive-only funding ratio. Do you have enough assets to cover the liabilities for your current retirees, the members who have already left the system? Issues of vested and non-vested benefits, which obviously has been a great topic of discussion here. You also can consider the financial conditions of the sponsor. One thing that's important when you're talking about looking at these projections of future dynamics is to not just assume that your assumptions are going to be right. If we assume that we do all these projections and we assume you're going to actually earn 8.16% every year, well, then things are could be hunky-dory. You could make a number of changes to your policy. But what happens if and when things don't turn out as you expect? Do certain changes in your funding policy mean that you're going to be hurting the fund and it's a funding position in the future if things don't just meet our expectations? This graph is actually it's a projection of the cost as a percentage of pay for your fund under your current funding policy. But again, this is an assumption that you are going to earn 8.16% per year. So when you're looking at and evaluating different funding policies, you'd want to look at graphs like this, but you'd also want to see what would happen, stress test those situations, what would happen if we had a series of bad returns or good returns.
So this is with our anticipated 8.16?
This is with anticipated 8.16% on the market value of assets. Although it does incorporate the losses from 2008 to 2009.
It does.
Yeah. That's why it seems spiking up. Also, you can see that in the projection of the funding ratio here, where you're seeing that the funding ratio is declining as we smoothen the losses from 2008 to 2009. And again, that lower line underneath is the inactive-only funding ratio. So that's the level of the assets needed just to cover your benefits for your current retired employees. Constraints. Well, you know, there are constraints on what the board can do. I'm sure you've all heard the equation at many SACRS meetings, C plus B equals I plus E, contributions plus benefits has to equal expenses plus investment earnings, money in has to equal the money out eventually. You can only reduce contributions by increasing investment earnings or lowering the plan costs. You're not deciding how much money has to, you can't reduce the contributions, you can only change when they're paid. Is it pay me now or pay me later? The decision that funding policies address. The exception to that is your decisions about non-vested benefits, where you've got discretion over certain benefits and whether or not they should be paid. But other than that, the board can really only accelerate or delay employer contributions. Talking about the amortization policy, what is the amortization policy? Well, it's basically defining how you get back on that track to full funding. There are a number of choices that you can make. The first would be the length, generally somewhere between 10 and 30 years. Whether it's going to be layered amortization or combined, that means do we amortize each year's gains and loss individually and pay them off over a specific period of time, or do we combine everything together and just amortize the unfunded liability over one specified period of time, which is how you currently do it. Do you amortize as a level dollar amount or as a level percentage of pay, where the payroll is assumed to grow, so the amortization payments also assumed to increase year by year? And do you have different amortization periods for different types of sources? There are plans in which they might amortize their gains and loss over one amortization period, but something like a plan amendment might be amortized somewhat differently. I think that could be reasonable if you think about something like a past service increase. You would want to amortize that over a short period because you know the members that are receiving that benefit have already earned that service or have maybe already retired. So to pass that on to future generations, to avoid passing it on to future generations, you might want a short amortization period. Or if it's a benefit increase for current active employees, you might want to limit the amortization to their remaining future working lifetime. So they're paying off that benefit increase over their working years. There are plans that do try to make different payment schedules for different types of either gains or losses or plan amendments. Generally, I haven't seen it too much in the 37 Act systems yet, but some places are thinking of changing that. There are pros and cons to different choices about amortization. If you are selecting a longer period, it's going to take you a longer time to get back to your goal. And in fact, if the period's long enough, the distance from your goal can actually increase. If you're using a level percentage of pay amortization with a period of greater than about 17 years, you'll have what's called negative amortization in the early years, where you're not paying the interest on the unfunded liability, and therefore the unfunded liability as a dollar amount can increase from year to year. It should still go down as a percentage of the total, though. The other thing about a long amortization period is you're, to some extent, passing costs on to future generations of taxpayers, which could be considered a violation of generational equity. Since the average expected working lifetime for active employees is usually somewhere between 10 and 15 years, if you're enhancing benefits for those members and you're passing those costs on beyond 10 to 15 years, you may be pushing some of those costs to future generations. There are disadvantages to shorter amortization periods as well. If you have a very short amortization period, you will end up with a very high volatility in the cost for the employer, which can be difficult for budget purposes. You could have a sizable gain or a loss in a single year, and then if you're amortizing that over a very short period, like 5 years, that's going to, you're going to see your contributions bounce around a lot more. That GFOA document, one of the things it recommends is a stable amortization period over time with parameters provided for making changes based on specific circumstances. I was just at Marin today, and they've got some special districts where their amortization period has been telescoping, and it's now under 10 years. And they just voted to increase it back up to a reasonable number, like 16 or 17, because when they get below that 10-year threshold, they're seeing their contributions bounce around a whole lot. But with a shorter amortization period, that would help you protect the benefit promise for the members. When the funding of the plan goes down, you're increasing the amount of money that you're asking for by the employers, so you're bringing them back closer to that full funding policy. Questions so far? There are specific guidelines out there with respect to funding amortization policy. GASB and the 37 Act currently allow for amortization periods no longer than 30 years. GASB recently went through what was called an invitation to comment, where they asked for comments on a whole range of issues surrounding GASB's pronouncements on how you have to report funding obligations for public sector pension plans. A lot of the comments, including those by public sector actuaries, did highlight that negative amortization issue and question whether 30 years is too long. A lot of us wouldn't be surprised if, when GASB finishes their process of looking at their accounting statements, that they might in fact shorten that maximum amortization period that you could use, possibly to something like 20 years. If not, I think they'll probably will definitely make some sort of statement about disclosing if you're using negative amortization. It's not guaranteed that that's going to happen, and they're still at the beginning of they haven't completed this process. I assume it'll still take a year or more to complete that process. But again, we wouldn't be surprised to see them shorten that maximum amortization period, although I would assume that they would have some sort of transition language in there that would allow plans that are at a longer amortization length to have some time to have their policies then conform with GASB regulations.
Graham, besides obviously raising the cost, if you shorten the amortization period, and say going into a negative amortization process isn't permitted, then is there any other, counties and employees would have to basically come up with the money?
GASB doesn't tell you what you need to fund. They only talk to you about your accounting statements.
Okay.
It would be the 37, the 37 Act sets that 30-year amortization maximum. I haven't heard any discussion yet about, changing the laws that govern your funding responsibilities. So GASB really only has jurisdiction over what goes in your financial statements. And there's no law currently that I'm aware of that says that you have to report exactly what you contribute. Those numbers don't necessarily have to be the same thing.
So it's a recommendation, let's just say.
It's a recommendation, or it's a requirement on the accounting side. Your current policy was recently changed last year from a 20-year level dollar amount, and that was contained in this 2003 funding policy, to extend it to 30-year level percentage of pay. So that does, it does reflect the fact that you are using negative amortization in the current years. Other 37 Act systems, there's a survey that was recently done by SACRs of all the systems and what their amortization policies are, and if they plan to make changes to them. A number of systems are considering changes. I think when looking at what all the systems are currently doing, the range was 9 to 27 years. I think that 9 changed this morning because I think that was just for Marin. So I think the next one is 10 years up to 27, with the average amortization period being about 19 years. I think the one exception might be Los Angeles, LA County, which I think also has a 30-year period, but it's just for a certain year's gains and losses, and those are telescoping over time. And almost all the systems use level percentage of pay amortization. And again, that 30-year amortization is being looked at increasingly skeptically by GASB and public actuaries. There was a large group of public actuaries that submitted comments to GASB in that invitation to comment that highlighted the amortization issue. Asset smoothing is the topic that we were originally asked to speak on. all your gains and losses, demographic, investments, anything like that, are going to be smoothed by the amortization period. I mean, the amortization policy is smoothing out all your gains and losses. But as you know, the investment returns are subject to a lot more volatility than any of the other assumptions. If your assets are 10 times what your payroll is and you lose 10% of your assets, that's a 100% loss as a percentage of payroll. So you know, even if you're smoothing that out, you recognize that can be a huge change in cost. So the actuaries have come up with these systems to smooth out those investment gains or losses, recognizing that there's a lot of volatility in the assets. By doing so, we generally only recognize a portion of the gains or losses that occur in each year, and then we use the smooth value of assets to compute the costs and the funded ratio. So the assets are double smooth. They're smooth through this asset smoothing method, and they're smoothed again when you go to amortize your unfunded liability. Okay. With asset smoothing, there are a number of choices as well. You've got the length of the smoothing period. There are plans out there using 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, up to 15 years. There's a concept of the corridor, or whether or not you're going to have a corridor around the market value of assets. The corridor just means that if we've smoothed out our gains or losses to a point where our actual value of assets is getting quite far away from the actual market value of those assets, do we put a constraint on there that says, look, we can't pretend that we have more than 20% more than we actually have when we're computing our costs? Again, you can talk about layered smoothing or combined rolling smoothing, and that's sort of a technical issue like it is for the amortization policy. Again, we've got pros and cons in both directions with asset smoothing. The benefits of more smoothing, which generally goes along with a longer smoothing period or a larger or no corridor, means you're going to reduce the volatility of the contributions. If your assets are actually earning 8.16% over the long run, we really shouldn't be affecting the overall level contributions, but we're making the contribution more level from year to year, which obviously... Or we assume is going to help the employer in their budgeting. It also allows the contributions to ramp up or down when there are times of severe asset swings. When you were going through the boom markets in the early part of the decade, your actuarial value of assets was actually lower than your market value of assets, so your contributions dropped slower than they would have if you were using the market value. Same thing in reverse. If you're losing a bunch of money, this smoothing allows you to have your contributions ramp up to a higher level rather than having dramatic shifts in cost. Then there are clearly going to be drawbacks to more smoothing. If the assets aren't actually earning 8.16% over the long run, and I know there are some board members that have brought up this issue, how are our long-term assumptions? Are we going to actually earn that long-term rate of return? Well, if your assets aren't earning that assumed rate and you're putting a lot of smoothing on the assets, basically what you're just doing is deferring the costs to later generations. Because, again, you're having the contributions ramp up to what they what they would be if you're using the market value, but they're lagging behind what the true cost of the benefits is, and you're therefore pushing those contributions onto future generations. Also, when you've got a period of severe down markets, and you're making contributions on a sort of a fictional level of assets, that can allow your funding ratio to decline. The normal actuarial funding with the market value of assets would say, look, you need to put more money into the plan. Well, if you're using an actuarial value of assets that's higher than market, you're not asking for as much money from the sponsors, so you're not improving the funding ratio as much as if you were using market values. There's increased headline risk. We've seen that in recent articles such as the one I distributed, where they talk about, is the smoothing of assets an accounting trick that's being used. Also, some people have, and this is not a definite yes or no issue, but some people have questioned whether there's market timing issues involved. Instead of putting in additional money when the markets are down, you're delaying increasing your contributions through these smoothing methods, then there's a risk that you're putting, you're asking for money after the markets have already recovered, the maximum, buy low, sell high. But then again, the reverse is also going to be true. If you're on the down slope, or you're on the up slope of increasing investment returns. Again, we have guidelines that govern assets moving. The actuarial standard of practice, number 44, talks about the actuary using an actuarial value of assets that should be reasonably close to the market value and should converge to the market value within a reasonable period of time. It is not specific at all as to what the word reasonable must mean. It also says that if you have a sufficiently narrow range around market value of assets or a sufficiently short period of time, then you don't need to be, it's an either or. If you're sufficiently on one or the other, you don't need to have both a corridor and a reasonable return to market value. There are a lot of actuaries out there that consider 5 years to be a sufficiently short period of time that you would not need a corridor about the market value of assets. We would just suggest that there are considerations about, you know, what's reasonable under the standards versus what would be considered to be best practice. The current practice is for 5 year smoothing with a 20% corridor. That's sort of the de facto standard that's evolved. That was actually written into the private sector regulations under ERISA. That's what private plans used to have to use, was 5 year smoothing with a 20% corridor. I believe PPA narrowed that, the Pension Protection Act narrowed that to a 10% corridor, but I think there's discussion of expanding it back to 20% due to the recent financial downturn. This GFOA recommended practice has a few comments. They say that smoothing period is typically 5 years, but there's no reason it can't be longer if controls are in place to, let's see, what is it? If controls are in place to assure any variation between market value and actual value does not become too large. It also says once a smoothing method is established, the retirement board should adhere to it and avoid making arbitrary changes to the methodology. That was one quote from the San Diego article. It said, here's the most elementary reason. What's the point of having a corridor if you just change it when the going gets tough? Now, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that in all circumstances, but it's a point many have raised. Any questions so far? Talk about what's currently going on in terms of asset smoothing. A number of systems are considering widening their corridor or extending their smoothing period for 2009. CalPERS and a few of the 37 Act systems are increasing their corridor for 30% or more, at least for the next few years. Some of them are proposing to do it for a few years and then bring it back down to 20%. Other systems, such as the San Diego City system, which voted after this article was written, they decided to retain their corridor. They were worried about deferring costs. They were worried about their declining funding ratio and wanting to get more money into the system, and the negative PR in the press referring to these as accounting tricks. And, obviously San Diego has specific issues in mind with respect to public relations. We definitely recommend the use of a corridor to keep valuation assets from drifting too far from market. We think that we know of some systems that have removed their corridors altogether, and we think that's not the wisest move. When you read all the material that talks about, you need to have the assets that you use have sort of some semblance of reality, and we're seeing plans that are having their actuarial to market value of assets go to 140-145%. So you're pretending you have 40% more assets than you actually have when you're calculating your contributions. We do think it's important to consider the amortization the asset smoothing policy with your other funding policies. If you've got a very liberal amortization period, you might have different thoughts on smoothing than if you had a very tight amortization policy. Your thoughts on smoothing might be different because of the impact of those graphs we show about projections of funding. How quickly are you going to recover? how low are your asset levels going to decline compared to your liabilities? So that's why we were very concerned with and really felt strongly about bringing all of these issues to you in sort of a unified whole rather than treating them individually. The contingency reserve issue. obviously, you know, not foremost on everybody's mind right now, just given that most people's contingency reserves have been wiped out by the current asset environment. You know, these are assets set aside out of the regular assets and or above the funding target to dampen the impact of inevitable events. Your current policy, I believe, targets 2% of the overall assets. Again, you're not going to have a contingency reserve when we're completing the 632,009 valuation because of the losses. I believe the 37 Act requires a minimum target of 1%, and most systems target somewhere between 1% and 3%. 1% to 3% of the assets isn't really a large buffer when you think about it, given that you've got gains and losses in your assets of well greater than 1% to 3% on a given year. But it does have some impact on how the employer contributions can change. Excess earnings. Excess earnings is a tricky issue. In the actuary's view, there really is no such thing as excess earnings. The gains, we set an investment return assumption. The gains are necessary to offset the losses because we assume 8.16% in the long term, but we know you're not going to earn that every year. So if excess earnings are skimmed from that return, our actual return assumption should probably be reduced. The GFOA practice note has something similar in it. It says any program that's derived from an excess earnings concept is detrimental to the funded status of the plan. That being said, the 37 Act is very clear on the fact that you do have flexibility and discretion with regard to setting up excess earnings policies. In the past, after having your contingency reserve at its designated level, returns above a certain rate have been shared between the employer through a reduction in their contributions and the members in terms of the non-vested benefit reserves. You have an excess earnings policy in place. One of the main features is that the prior losses have to be paid back before excess earnings are shared again. That's the concept of the contra account. I know that you have, a standing committee that's looking at this, at your excess earnings policies, and I believe San Diego perhaps put in a policy recently that based their excess earnings on funding status, and I think that was something the board was looking at. There is definitely a wide diversity of policies in the 37 Act systems. I just came from a system that doesn't even really have a policy put into place, which is okay today because they don't have any excess earnings, but they are desperate to have something put in writing eventually. Other policies that could be a part of your funding policy that you could consider, looking at your investment policy and how does that integrate and look with your funding policy. I think Bob McCrory may have made a presentation before where he talked about something called stable funding, where if you were to come back to getting closer to 100% funded or above 100% funded, you might take some of your chips off the table, move to more secure investments that in some ways match the liabilities for your retirees. That could secure the benefit promise, help ensure generational equity, guarantees the promises before you got into an overfunded position where you might be making more promises, and it could reduce your portfolio risk and the volatility of the cost. But obviously anything that reduces volatility, guarantees less volatility is going to have some kind of a cost to it. We mentioned this policy because San Joaquin is currently integrating it into their funding policy. They're taking, they are putting together a funding policy document that also directly addresses their investment policies.
Now, wouldn't that affect also, but if you did something like that, wouldn't you also have to look at that time, wouldn't you have to look at your, what your expected return is, because isn't that going to go down? So wouldn't you have to, it's kind of somehow, if you decided, okay, we're going to put so much of our funds in, more secure, which usually are, lower yielding type,
right.
fixed or something. I mean, aren't you then going to have to say, okay, when we do this, we're going to have to look at our, earnings assumption and
exactly
that, because you're probably not going to get that 8% or whatever you've been planning on
right.
at that point.
That's a very important part of the policy itself, is that now we're talking in happy land where the plan is now at 110% funded, right? Well, if you're taking some of the investments out of the equity portfolio and putting them in sort of matched bonds, you're going to reduce the expected rate of return. which is going to reduce the funded ratio, which gets you back closer to 100. You know, your plan is always going to be closer to 100% funded. So that prevents those, I don't remember the presentation Bob made on pension plans failing up, right? You get 120% funded, people grant more benefits, and then when the markets tank, now you've got a larger asset to payroll ratio, and we're seeing larger increases in costs. Well, under this, what we call stable funding, the funding ratio never goes to 100%, right? Because as you move the assets into the bond portfolio, your expected rate of return goes down, and your funding ratio goes down and stays closer to 100%.
So you're saying do that when you're close to 100, not do it when you're at 70.
Sanofi is thinking of adopting it in small ways now with respect to their current bond portfolio and matching it tighter to their retiree liabilities, to a portion of their retiree liabilities. Paul is also the consultant. Paul of SIS is consultant there, and he's working with Bob on trying to implement this now, or at least get it started. Obviously, they're not moving a lot of money out of equities and into bonds, but they're trying to at least match some of the older retiree liabilities, the cash flows, to their current bond portfolio.
Okay.
May I ask a question? Are there any 37 acts that are currently at 100%?
No. I don't believe so.
Okay.
I would be better.
Just when you commented about 100%, I thought, who would that be? Okay. Thank you.
Nobody right now.
Okay.
That is happy land.
We'd be picking their brains.
Or pockets.
Or pockets.
A few other plans have put into place contribution limits. They've put a floor on the employer contributions. Something like we're not gonna allow the contribution to go below the normal cost, you know, the benefits that you're earning this year, or to have some sort of a minimum amortization period for surplus as opposed to an unfunded liability. So you can't spend down your surplus and put your employer contribution to zero, as we saw some plans do, you know, around 2000, especially, you know, CalPERS plans that had contribution rates of zero for a while because they were amortizing their surplus and it drove the contribution down to nothing. CalPERS now says the contribution will never go below, I think, something like 50% of the normal cost. Obviously, that's not an issue right now. That only becomes an issue if you become overfunded. The benefits to something like that would be increased funding discipline by the employer. You don't get used to granting these benefits at a cost of zero. You increase the opportunity to do those things we were talking about, securing the benefits. There's a question as to whether that's a asymmetric funding policy. Does it encourage overfunding, right? Because you're always asking for more money into the plan. And could you be overcharging the current generation of taxpayers? Obviously, this contribution limit is probably not an issue right now, given that your contributions are going to be above the normal cost for the foreseeable future. Okay, so just in summary, we definitely recommend that you look at funding policy as elements of a whole, looking at amortization smoothing, that you study the impact on the plan and the ability to achieve your objectives if you're thinking of making changes, and when you look at those, when we do those projections, look at uncertain events, not just assuming you're going to earn 8.16 every year. And this document that you guys had in 2003, a formal funding policy, we think is a great idea. It's something that the San Joaquin Board just approved last Friday. I'm happy to share a copy of theirs with you. But it's nice to have this all in one place, and you can see how you've developed this program as a whole. So I've talked long enough. Any questions?
I have a question in mind. The 09, fiscal year 09, is not very far along as far as...
Oh, no, it's pretty far along. We're done with the data work. I think we anticipate being able to... Tom, we talked about a draft report in December.
Oh, great. So can you tell us what funding level is now as of...
I can tell you based on the asset returns. This is only the asset experience. We haven't incorporated any changes for demographics. We haven't included any assumption changes that we might be making the experience study, which is going to be after the valuation. But if you're looking here, I think the funding ratio for the plan as a whole was somewhere in the mid-80s as of 6/30/08, based on the actual value of assets. That'll decline to 71-72% as of June 30th, 2009. That's using your current policies, your 30-year amortization on the unfunded liability, your 5-year smoothing of the 20% corridor. And then it'll continue to decline as you recognize the rest of those. Remember, we're only recognizing a portion of the losses in the current year. You are hitting that 20% corridor, so we're not smoothing all 80. We're not smoothing 80% of the losses, because otherwise the actual value of assets would be further than 20% from the market value. But we all are still deferring some of those losses, and that's why you can see the funding ratio continue to decline for the for a 5-year period. This graph assumes that you're earning 8.16%. In all of those years.
And this does not include those demographic issues that the McMillan report raised, but we did not address yet.
That's correct. It doesn't address things like have mortality rates changed significantly, which we'll be looking at as part of your experience study. It does incorporate those level one changes,
right,
that we made about the withdrawals and
right.
Correct.
Where does that go? In your estimation, are those very consequential?
I'd hesitate to say until we looked at the demographic experience. I've looked at other plans recently. The nice thing is I'm doing an experience study for another plan that we'll have completed right before we start yours, which is nice because we have a lot of information we're collecting on investment returns and that kind of stuff. But for that plan, their demographic changes to their assumptions outside of mortality were basically a wash, I think maybe a few tenths of a percent. Their costs as a percentage of pay are probably going up by 1 to 1.5% because their mortality experience has improved. We want to put in some more conservative tables. I can't say whether or not that's going to be the same situation for your plan, but that's just, another plan that I've looked at recently. Probably not seeing the huge demographic losses because a lot of people are trying to hold on to their jobs. So they're delaying retirements, which tends to hold down costs if they can. Unless you've got a whole bunch of early retirement incentives in place, which will push up costs.
Okay, I think we're moving on now to Section B. The overview of the presentation for November
17th. I hadn't intended on going through this through the presentation in this entirety, unless you would like me to. We assume that this presentation is going to take an hour to an hour and a half when we make it at the educational workshop. I wanted to maybe flip through it and show you sort of what we're, what we had intended to present, and if there are any things that you would really like us to, and this is a presentation for the stakeholders. If you have suggestions, if you have things that you'd like us to see or take out of the presentation, we're definitely open to suggestions. Obviously this isn't a finalized presentation. We wanted your input. If you're just looking at the handout, but the second slide just talks about the subjects we wanted to look at. Just giving in, actuarial terminology is obviously confusing and can put people to sleep if they don't understand what's going on. So we wanted to go through some of the pension basics. If you recall, we did an exercise in saving for college. We've sort of honed that example, and we find it to be pretty effective in terms of explaining actuarial terminology, what's the accrued liability, what's the normal cost. So we'd like to at least spend a little time going over that with the member, with the stakeholders, and then how does that example equate to pension benefits? How is the funding target like the accrued liability? How is the amortization policy? How is the amortization policy translate to the real world? And that leads into a discussion about how actuarial funding works. If you turn to page 5 of the slides, the bottom slide starts talking about actuarial assumptions. We wanted to get a little bit into, what kind of assumptions do we make? You know, we're using actuarial assumptions to calculate a best estimate contribution for the employers, the types of demographic assumptions we use, and then getting into the economic assumptions. You know, what is the system's economic view? What is your return assumption? What are the ranges that other people are using? You know, how do you compare? You know, what are the inflation assumptions you're using, and how do those compare? And then talk about how the board is responsible for setting those assumptions based on input from their, you know, input from their advisors, and how we're performing an experience study to review and develop those assumptions. And to point out that, again, you know, the actuary is always wrong when, you know, in setting these assumptions year to year, where we don't have a crystal ball that tells us the future, but the pension funding principles allow us to have a self-correcting mechanism for getting back on track. If you look at the bottom of page 6, we have a slide about, you know, where are we now and where are we going, talking about how we project future contributions, how we look at future funding ratios. If you look at the bottom of page 7, we have, you know, that infamous spaghetti chart where we try to communicate some of the uncertainty that's contained in a pension plan. And then after that, we start getting into the choices that the board has. You know, we talk about the no free lunch principle. The board's decisions are about paying now versus paying later. And basically, going through the presentation that I just made, simplifying it somewhat because they don't need the level of detail that you guys need to make your decisions. But touching on, you know, what's amortization policy, what's smoothing policy, those sorts of issues. We have a couple slides at the very end on what the employer can do to affect contributions, and our main recommendations are about, you know, reviewing your compensation policies and administrative systems, particularly to avoid spiking, you know, because that can be a really it's an easy issue for the press to pick up. It may be fairly rare in its actual occurrence, but it's something that generally you can take care of if you've got you know, careful compensation policies. And you know, just emphasizing that, you know, stakeholders need to work together with the retirement board, the board of supervisors, and the other employers, the employee organizations, and the retirees to, you know, to figure out solutions to the problems you guys all face.
Is that your company mascot?
Flying pig. Bob loves that slide.
What's the significance?
One big fly.
Mm-hmm. When the actuary is always right, it makes everyone happy. I think that's
one big little fly.
That was a really brief overview of an hour and a half presentation.
Who's going to make that presentation?
Bob and myself.
Bob and myself
will be there. We both got it on our schedules. I know you know, this workshop was your idea, and I thought it was a great idea. You know, we're clearly looking for any input, anything else you would like us to address that you think stakeholders should be aware of.
Well, one of the things I was sort of concerned about, the program was going to be a kind of come-and-go thing, and it sounds like maybe your presentation is going to be a very important mark.
I think it had been scheduled that each of the advisors...
It's more of just a presentation, Wes. We'll have some break time for people to go in an ante-room kind of to look at some charts and things like that, but it will be specific. I'll be kind of overviewing the accounting that I did with the board about a month or so ago, just to kind of tell them where we are accounting-wise. Graham and Bob will be there to say, here's where we are actuary-wise, and Paul Hart will give them the investment pictures. And so it'll be
a set program.
Set program, right.
Okay. Because right, I thought when we were talking about there was going to be a come-and-go thing. And in other words, a lot of the employees probably all the employees can't come at a certain time. And that was what I was concerned about.
I think the employees, this is my assumption, is that the employee representatives will mostly be there as opposed to the employees themselves. Simply, it's just a matter of, you know, can you go, which is getting a little tight. But in just previous discussions with some of the employee representatives, in a lot of ways, not that you know, a lot of us have been at this for a while, but this is a very difficult concept to understand at one try. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it can be. So I think the language that you use here seems to be pretty good, but I would anticipate questions, just to clarify.
I hope there are questions.
Yeah.
What's attendance look like? Do you have any clue?
We don't have any response yet. We're going to send out another message this week, end of this week.
Hmm. Have you guys heard from anyone?
Who's been invited?
We've invited retiree representatives, the Western Board of Directors, employee representatives, employer representatives, HR people, budget people.
What about general retirees like myself?
That would be through RESCO. Each of those organizations should be broadcasting if they want any of their members to show up.
Unless you're stopped at the door.
No. So didn't seem that there were any topics that haven't been addressed here that you wanted us to bring up at the meeting itself.
I just think it's a good overview. Again, with questions, you'll get more of a maybe pointed discussion going that way. Because we don't know what a particular focus may be, except that it comes down to the bottom line where what does this mean in terms of dollars, in terms of where we're looking at it, employee-employer contributions in the future.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have the administrator.
Okay, board members received evaluation for SAS to provide their subjective evaluation of SAS services and looking at potential renewal of the contract, which comes due almost a year from now, next June. 2010, and Gordon Ford, the chair of the retirement board, had a letter which was distributed to members to be discussed as kind of a different method of trying to find some kind of mathematical way in seeing what value SAS has made for the fund. You've all read the letter and my letter in evaluation form from SAS. As I had stated in the letter, when we threw out the information about is there some kind of a review process for the consultant, we didn't get any response back that said, yeah, we'd use this or we'd use that service to review our consultant. All it was we do an RFP that the consultant cannot have it for services, but we just want to compare costs and so on. I know it's very difficult to try to compare investment returns. If you look at a one-year period or a five-year period or a 10-year period or a 30-year period, those are all different periods of time. And you do it as of June 30th of 2007 when the market is higher than it's ever been, or you do it as of June 30th of 2009 when it's been up and down. You know, all the figures change. It looks like stocks didn't make money for 10 years after last December. And it's like, well, we know that 30 years we've made money in stocks. So if we just took December 31st, 2008 snapshot, we'd say, get out of stocks and move forward just with fixed income or nothing or banks or whatever. So I know it's very difficult to try to compare, depending on the period of time that you use, different investment strategies. It's going to be very difficult. And in the analysis, I guess my concern with Mr. Ford is that he has issues, I guess, apparently from the letter, with SIS, which are not going to be resolved by any mathematical computations. I mean, he has some basic differences in their assumptions, how they view their work and so on. So I don't think that's going to be resolved by mathematical. Yeah, they added $2 million, over what another asset allocation would have been. I guess what we would have to do to find out more in particular, if we were to do some kind of mathematical analysis, is what are we going to compare this to? Are we going to start with, here was the original investment program before SAS took over, and then we're going to track that. What would that have been had we stayed with that investment program, and how are we going to calculate that? Does anybody know? What would that be today? What would that have been in 07? What would that have been in 09? Are we are we going to try to track, because he wants to track like every single change. You know, SAS recommended doing this. SAS said it was okay for them to, you know, not adhere to the 5% policy over here, and so on. Are we going to be able to track that against what? Is there some kind of, you know, do we take the top 10 stocks? Do we take the passive index? You know, those are some things that a lot of details in there that would have to be ironed out before we move forward with any kind of analysis on that. And I thought, you know, as a basic analysis, we could attempt. Probably the easiest thing would be, or what I could understand, would be to attempt to take what was the portfolio, because I believe we only had three managers before SAS came on board, and that was Putnam International, Dodge & Cox stock, and Dodge & Cox fixed income. Clearly, we've kept Dodge & Cox stock and Dodge & Cox fixed income. We've got figures on that that could probably be projected out as a percent of the total. We don't have Putnam anymore. How would you project out what their management would have given us in the international? Do you use an international index for them? Do you ask Putnam what your returns have been? Had you been our manager for the last 9 years? Again, a lot of questions like that. You're going to have to come up with some assumptions. And then, of course, assumptions will give you sometimes what your end result is. So if you come up with, you know, those kinds of things. So I, you know, it's up to the board if they want to pursue some kind of analysis of SIS's recommendations. My thought is that it's going to be costly, it's going to be time-consuming and costly, and I don't know if we're going to be able to get an exact, accurate, you know, picture.
Madam Chairman, I think that this is a great big game of what if. We were on the top for 9 years under SIS. There's no way in the world, other than fairy dust, that we could come up with all these figures, and it would be all somebody's approximation of, oh yes, I could have done better, or no, I wouldn't have. The world is in a financial meltdown right now, and it's not the fault of SIS. We've had a reduction in the amount of money that we have in our portfolio, and it's not due to poor management. It's due to a financial meltdown of the world. Now, the things are starting to pick back up again, and so that we would be looking at, you know, what happens if Mr. Obama does one thing or something else, or Mr. Putin decides to do something, or Israel decides to bomb, you know. It could be a whole new world tomorrow, and we just waste our time. We hired SIS, the corporation, not SIS Paul Hart. We've had good luck with SIS, and if you look at other people in the same position, we've been on top when they've been down at the bottom. We're down a ways now, but there's nothing to say that we won't be back up very shortly, and this will all go away, and everybody will be happy. The only thing that we could do differently would be to put it in gold bullion and bury it in the back of Ron's bank. That way we'd know what was there. But this is just, you know, this is a waste of time and money as far as I'm concerned.
One of the, I think I shared this with Gordon, is that I really hadn't noticed any particular, I mean, we always have questions for Paul. We ask him for recommendations. Plus, many of you have the expertise to say, yeah, that's a good direction to go in. Ultimately, it comes down to the board making decisions. I know that Gordon has had been pretty vocal in his concerns regarding us going outside of the guidelines of policy, but there have been very valid reasons that we have agreed to as a board. And if that is the only concern, and I guess what I'm asking is this a time for the other board members to vocalize any of their concerns with SIS and or Paul himself in particular? Because I myself have not heard him here at this table. Whether there are comments or concerns outside, I don't know. So this might be a good opportunity to air some of those things, but otherwise I do agree with Mike. I think this is going into a full investigation of the what-ifs may or may not be necessary at this point because of maybe perhaps one individual's concerns.
Did you make a motion?
seen him.
Well, I saw Gordon in the elevator last week, and he mentioned this to me, this item. And I asked him, I said, do you want to hold this over till you're here? And he indicated no. He didn't want this held over. And while this is a very strongly phrased letter, especially the third paragraph, he didn't want to have it held over to have us discuss it, you know, in more detail. So I, absent that, I agree with Mike. If people want to, I mean, I think as a philosophy, there should be some performance review of everybody at some period of time, somehow. But I don't know if this is the way to do it in terms of SIS right now. I don't.
And maybe we should do a review of the board members.
That's actually not
good corporate governance.
That's right not. Now. I agree with that.
I think what Gordon wants is for us to go out and look at other alternatives for investment managers. I think that's where he's headed with all of this. And I think that boils down to the same thing we do when we look at money managers. We have their history. We have no idea what they're going to do for the next year, 5 years. And we kind of boil it down to a style and then a personality based on the presenters. Or the chief investment officer, whatever he tells us, we either get excited with his philosophy or not, and that's how we choose. And Paul just opens up the universe for us, or an investment manager does. They give us some recommendations, or kind of filter through the top 10 or 12 and give us 3 or 4 to look at. But a new manager isn't going to do it any differently or bring us, maybe they'll bring us some better choices, but maybe we won't make good choices. So it's, we're comfortable with Paul and SIS.
Yep. And we've got an asset program or policy.
Yeah, I think changing now is just reacting to a meltdown, as Mike said. You know, we can't control that. And it, you know, we were at the beginning of this, we were pretty heavily in fixed income, so we were pretty conservative to start with. You know, I don't know what this accomplishes to go resway. There's no way we can quantify what somebody else would have done. And if we're not comfortable with SIS or Paul, then we should go out and look for a consultant. But I think most of us are happy. And the fund has done fairly well, except given the last 18 months. But nobody's done very well.
And then he has gotten us some reduction in cost, yeah, which helps a lot, too.
I'd like to point out one fact, too. Merced County has 5 consultants and 24 money managers with a portfolio about half the size of ours. Now, you could ask Tom where their standings have been for the last couple of years on the winner's ladder.
Darren, you had a comment.
Well, I would just say that, you know, is this a good discussion, dialogue to have? And I would say yes. I mean, you know, SIS is a very integral and important part of what we do. You know, we trust them. We have a relationship with them. And ultimately, they're going to guide us based upon our policy and our asset allocations, where we're going to go. I think we have to look individually and, you know, and ask ourselves, how well have they done compared to what we know in our peer group? And, you know, we've all been to conferences. We get input from other entities, such as our actuaries and other folks, that let us know how well other plans are doing. And, you know, other plans have been down, you know, 40%. I don't know if you want to use that as a benchmark to the extreme, but obviously there are some worst-case scenarios out there with respect to performance and where systems have been guided. And ultimately, they guide themselves based upon their policy and where they allow themselves to go. And, you know, some were chasing the extremes. And they were getting into hedge funds and very highly risky and speculative investments. And ultimately, as Ron pointed out, that comes down to what the board is comfortable with. So I think really the primary focus here is based upon our policy and our asset allocations. Has SIS done what we've asked them to do based upon that policy framework? And I would have to say yes. I mean, Paul knows. He's come in here and told us, you know, yeah, other people are doing this, some folks are doing this, but in our opinion, in my opinion, that's too risky. And we're not going to recommend that. You know, some board members have asked for, you know, money, you know, currency overlay programs, and, you know, we listen to one discussion and we collectively realize that that is just something too risky, too volatile that we do not want to get ourselves into. So I think that's really the general discussion, and I have to say personally I've been happy with SIS, and I disagree that, you know, just by having this discussion and then, you know, renewing their contract, that somehow is I'm giving up or abdicating my fiduciary responsibility. I disagree with that. I think, again, it's important that we have this dialogue, this discussion, and if we're collectively happy with his performance, or as Mike pointed out, with SIS's performance, then we move forward from here.
Wes?
One of the things we have at our disposal is Sackers has R.V. Coons that does the study every year on all the systems. There's like 100 public systems, which include the 37 Act counties. And so we are getting, you know, a comparison of what the progress is and what the results are. And I think we've been very happy with. Lately, everyone's been, you know, having a bad investment experience. But so we are getting some comparison, and I've been very happy.
Yeah, we've been ahead. I mean, yeah, we've been ahead.
Exactly.
If that's the measurement, yeah. I mean, it seems to me that's the most important one.
Actually, back in 2001, 2003, where the market did slip somewhat after significant events in the world, we actually. In a bad time, we did pretty darn well. And again, that was under the guidance of SIS. And this board, I think Darren mentioned it, we tend to be pretty conservative ourselves. And I go back to the comment that I made, is we ultimately make that decision. So before we take action on SIS, you know, I haven't heard any indication, but this is the time to make any comments regarding whether we want to do an RFP for a new consultant, or if we're happy with what we got. So that's where the vote goes.
Okay. Now, how about the question of the questionnaire? Is that in this discussion too?
Well, I think that's just that goes by the board. I would think that we have no action on this part of this subject, and we don't even worry about the questionnaire. The questionnaire has no merit as far as I'm concerned anyway, but we're not telling what Paul is doing. We're not reviewing Paul's
right.
individual thing. We have a contract with SIS, not with Paul Hart. And while we're on this subject, I'd like to bring up another one. One of the reasons why that came up in the last meeting was that we have more than one money market manager who has the same stock as somebody else. What in the world could that make any difference? You know, if company ABC is on the market and selling like crazy in small cap, and they're another Microsoft, why wouldn't all the money market managers buy the stuff? What difference does it make? It, you know, other than the fact if we get to the point that 20% of our overall investment is in that company, then we got a problem. But until that point, we have no right, as far as I'm concerned, to tell the money market managers that you can't buy Cisco, or you can't buy Microsoft, or you can't buy this particular stock.
Well, I do believe we have the policy. I'm trying to remember if it crosses money managers, but basically each money manager themselves are limited to a certain percentage of buying.
Yes, that's right.
Right.
So if they all bought, say, 5% of Cisco, for which is a good stock right now, which is booming, if they bought 5% of Cisco, we could have 20% from four Marty market managers, but they're not in the same category, so we couldn't have 20%.
And that's where, again, we have to take, we have to keep an eye on those things, I believe, in terms of, and Paul.
Well, I think Paul does that too, because they have in their contract that
that
we can't have more than X number of percentage of one particular company.
So basically then, I go back to your question about whether this is a decision on the review and the evaluation of the investment consultant, or are we dealing with Gordon's letter addressing his concern?
Well, on the agenda item, if I'm correct, if counsel can help me out here, this would just be addressing the letter.
Mm-hmm.
So no action taken at this point regarding his mathematical study of the comparison. I mean, I'll basically concur.
Sounds like it.
And the survey is separate.
Okay.
Yeah, and if Tom runs across some brilliant scheme to make all this stuff, he's
right.
He's going to tell us.
Right. Right.
So.
One to five. Trust me, I've often thought, what would we have done if we had gone with, money manager A versus money manager B? But that's only kind of self-defeating because we made a decision. And that's what we go by.
Well, and another thing is, even if you didn't have SIS, you would have made some decisions on your own. And what would those have been? There's no way. I mean, there's no way to go back and try to second guess what you would have done 2 or 3 years ago.
So.
That
is what
kind of. I just stole everything and gone in the gold.
In the backyard. Under the mattress.
So the minutes will reflect no action taken.
No action taken. Actually, there's quite a labyrinth over there at the Oak Valley Bank in Oakdale. It's a long walk in there.
Okay. Discussion action on the SACRS nominating committee's recommended changes to the SACRS election procedures bylaws. I reviewed the documents, and while on the one hand I'm all for getting things done and what the nominating committee did, I think was very good work. However, given the bylaws committee's reservations and also the director's board of directors letter, again stating the nominating committee did wonderful work for the election processes for SACRS. However, I don't see it falling apart. I would certainly recommend that the board move forward to not put the recommendation into place at this meeting, but wait until the governance structure is a little further defined in SACRS with the permanent executive director, whatever they're going to call it, and the governance structure is being reviewed. I think they're going to say in about a year from now that they should have all that in place. And so I'm kind of leaning towards, or I would recommend moving towards the board of directors comment of just kind of wait. Hold this material and then wait until we get the executive director on board and then move forward with any changes in election processes.
We survived until now with this process.
Right.
So then no action taken?
Well, I think our representative Darren and Wes need probably some direction from the board whether they want to follow through with that or go with the nominating committee.
Can I say something? I'm on the bylaws committee, and I worked on the final result of this. And if you notice in the president's report, even president of the officers of the SACRS, thus while the SACRS board of directors is not taking any position on the merits of the proposed bylaw changes, they've been proposed by the nomination committee. It is concerned that the time and effort spent by your board of retirement may be ultimately untimely, it says. Anyway, they're not making any recommendation either. It was a lot of work. Sean Terrace the immediate past president is the one who was chairman of the nominating committee. And I'll leave it at that.
Excuse me, that's an in crowd joke. Ms. Terrace has a problem. Let's leave it at that.
But if Darren's going to be the delegate, and so if you have any instructions, he and I, as the alternate delegate, would be very happy to hear your recommendations on the voting.
Well, I mean, you're the delegate, though, on behalf of the board, so I really think the board should be giving you direction.
That's what I'm saying.
So what's the feel of the board?
Doesn't sound like the board cares.
How about if you want to make a motion and second, if it's with the council's, she concurs to direct the voting delegates to vote accordingly.
Actually, I can't make a motion, huh? I don't know. I think Tom's recommendation has some merit.
Okay, I move Tom's recommendation.
Sorry.
What is that, though? There's no action taken.
No, we're not going
to. To not support the nominating committee's changes to bylaws.
Okay.
At this point.
Okay.
Good work. Needs a little
Mike
more.
Lynch, your motion.
Well, I call for the question.
And seconded by.
Did we have a second from?
Yeah.
Ron. Ron. Here. Okay, Ron.
So, seconded by Ron.
Any additional discussion?
I regret these
actions. Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Madam Chairman, I request before we move into closed session, we take a 5-minute break.
So deemed.
Was there to be a
break? Sorry,
to be action on A?
Exactly. Go ahead, sorry.
Was there supposed to be an action on A? So the discussion.
We took no action.
Took no action.
Oh, okay.
Under the Brown Act, it gives them the
gavel sound. We're back in session.
Is that what makes the computer now shake and come back on?
We need sound effects.
Need a motion, or does well, just, after you?
First, I want to make okay. just announce that on 8C, the item is anticipated litigation, significant exposure to litigation pursuant to subdivision B1 of section 54956.9, and that is the potential litigation referring to the claim of Mike O'Neill, who's the president of RESCO.
So I have to recuse myself?
That is really going to be your call, because it's whether you, in as a person who is a member of RESCO, and you know, you've got to, it's going to be your call as to whether you can sit as the board, as a board member, sitting in closed session. You are able to do it under the law, but it's up to you whether you can, one, retain as all members of the board. Are required is to retain confidentiality of what's said in closed session, and whether you can actually be impartial to sitting on.
Do I do this before or when? Just when it comes up.
What do you mean before when it comes up?
Just on the session.
We're going to be in a closed session.
It would be at the time we can. Okay. You can be here, and then we can at that time. If you want to recuse yourself, we can do that. Okay. We'll announce that you did. Okay.
Or you can listen to it and promise not to tell.
Remember, this is Vegas.
Now
we can have a motion.
I move that we're going to close session.
Second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? We're now in closed session. They have to hear the gavel.
Excellent.
Want me to report it out?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, let's see here.
15,000.
The findings of the closed session are as follows. Item 8A, set the matter for hearing before a hearing officer and address the issue regarding Government Code Section 31722. Item number 8C, motion was made by Darren Garrett and seconded by Ron Martin to reject the claim as filed by Michael O'Neill and hire Reed Smith in all matters related to the claim.
Also that Wes Hall.
Oh, well, I was going to have that written. He recused himself at the time I wrote down here. And he came back at 4:18.
And then also not present, you want it so that it's because so that it's clear who voted for, because you have to report out who voted for.
Okay.
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 Okay. Members forum. You're first this time.
Nothing.
Mike?
No, I have nothing to say.
Nothing.
Michael. Nothing.
Nothing.
Okay. Joyce, got anything there?
Nothing.
Nothing.
And nothing for me. Meeting adjourned.
Good precedent. So.